Sarah Gardner. We're in Hawaii this week to enjoy the palms. Not for shade as you relax on sandy beaches. These palms are grown by island farmers to produce a tasty ingredient for your dinner table.
Hi, I'm Akiba Howard. So, you ready to saddle up? Well, we're going to take you out west to California, where one woman is carrying on a cattle ranching tradition begun by her family generations back.
Hi there, I'm Rob Stewart. We're taking you to New Orleans this week on America's Heartland. The Big Easy is known for its famous cuisine, and Bourbon Street is known for its bars. We will show you how Louisiana sugarcane is turned into a world-famous drink. That's next on America's Heartland.
You can see it in the eyes of every woman and man in America's heartland, living close to the land. There's a love for the country and a pride in the brand in America's heartland, living close to the land.
No matter how you make your living, you probably know that being successful these days demands multiple skills and multitasking. And for one young farm couple here in Kentucky, that means doing a number of things very well.
Sometimes farming is about hydraulics and hoses. Before Aaron Redding will plant any seeds this season, he's got to get his giant planter operating.
That's got to come back this way.
This does.
Yeah, and waxing poetic about legacy or loving the land takes a back seat when the darn thing just won't work right.
Here's what we need to do. This connector thing needs to come off of there.
And with a little teamwork, he gets it done.
A lot of different hoses go to a lot of different places there, it looks
yeah,
like.
Yeah, and apparently the markers came off a few of the hoses, but with enough help, we can find a way to get everything hooked up.
Soon, this tractor and planter will be going strong day and night planting soybeans. Aaron and his family grow corn, soybeans, and winter wheat on about 9,000 acres of central Kentucky ground. The Redding's corn gets used to make bourbon whiskey, and their soybeans will likely end up as animal feed after being sold on the grain market. Today, the farm ownership is in the hands of Aaron and his sister, Anna. When she's not working at her full-time job at a nearby hospital, you'll find her driving grain trucks. And inside the home office is Aaron's wife, Ashley.
I handle human relations, landowner relations, and public relations. So I'm the relations expert for the farm.
After working in the private sector for years, she's now working on the farm full-time, handling business matters in the office.
And then we had our third child, and things just got a little hectic. It was hard. I didn't feel like I was doing a good job anywhere. It was the third child that pushed this, but it came at the exact time that the growth in our operation lent itself to that possibility as well.
Aaron, do you copy?
Go ahead.
Well, I've got these new logo concepts in, so if you can swing by sometime this afternoon, we can look at them.
On first blush, going over logo concepts for a farm might seem unusual, but like any successful farmers, the Reddings see farming as a business. Just like any other family-owned small business, they take risks, adjust, and adapt to new challenges and opportunities.
It is still a business, and we have to make a profit here. We can't do this just because we like it.
And the latest challenge facing this family is as personal as it gets. Aaron recently was diagnosed with ALS, known as Lou Gehrig's disease. It's a neurodegenerative disease that affects nerve cells in the brain and spinal cord.
I've noticed some progressive weakness in some limbs, and over the winter, they finally did officially diagnose it as ALS.
There's no cure for the progressive degeneration of the motor neurons that eventually leads to death.
I love farming. I've always loved farming. And I'm not going to let a physical ailment or physical condition or deficiency keep me from farming. Farming is more than just the physical labor. I can farm from the chair and the desk and the computer in here in the office if that is what I eventually get to the point of having to do.
We had time to think about it and to come to terms with it, And Aaron's a fighter and determined, and farming's his passion. Like I said, it doesn't take long to realize that. And this is his farm, and he's going to run it.
And judging by their choice of toys, the next generation of Reddings is ready for the challenge. Okay.
I did see a few cut worms.
For now, Aaron relies on agronomist Daniel Reynolds to keep track of crop progress.
They can get up a good inch and a half in size.
Whether it's seasonal challenges like tackling pests, daily chores like starting up seed equipment, or the painful prognosis of a debilitating disease, determined realism in the face of adversity is how the Reddings have taken on challenges big and small. That, combined with the teamwork and togetherness found across the heartland, is what has sustained this family and their farm.
It goes back to building a business for successive generations, and as long as I'm able to continue working toward that goal, I'm not going to let a disease or anything else stand in the way of that.
Call it a Civil War coincidence. Union President Abraham Lincoln and Confederate President Jefferson Davis were both born in Kentucky. The Bluegrass State is the place where Colonel Harlan Sanders invented Kentucky Fried Chicken. And the next time you sing Happy Birthday to You, thank two sisters from Kentucky who wrote the song in 1893.
Running a cattle ranch demands a number of skills. There's breeding stock to consider, feed for the animals, and of course it's helpful if you're handy on horseback. Well, for one California cattlewoman, that ranching know-how has long been a part of the family tradition.
Is that a bull?
Bull.
Yeah.
Sheila Bowen thinks that a little instruction on horseback is the perfect way to teach the next generation about their ranching heritage. After all, cattle have been raised on this family land for more than a century.
And it's just been a blessing for us to get to raise our children here and to live this lifestyle.
The family's Carver Bowen Ranch raises cattle in these rolling oak-covered hills of California's Kern County, some 150 miles north of Los Angeles. City folks might think that ranching is strictly a male occupation, but all across the heartland, women play a key role in raising cattle and sheep.
Make sure it's got a chain on it, because we're going to sort into that lane.
Sheila's life as a rancher began in the late 70s when she first met her husband Jeff in college.
When we were dating, Jeff used to bring me up and we would do whatever chores needed to be done, and then we would go fish in the ponds and have a great time catching bass and bluegill. And I would go home, and I have four brothers and two sisters, and I would tell them, you know, that we got to go fishing in the pond up there in the mountains, and they wanted to come along on the next date so they could take part in that.
The mother of four allowed the ranching experience to envelop her.
We feel that we are contributing to the food that feeds this nation and this world, and to the extent that our little piece is helping, we're very proud of that.
Most consumers have a limited idea of the work involved in running a ranch. For Sheila and her family, it's meant efforts to improve their land while raising Hereford and Angus beef for market. Those elements play a major role in her public outreach efforts with the Kern County Cattlewomen's Association.
So the fact that we're going to get to have some actual footage in there of the live action will be add a lot to it, and I think it'll make it real special.
She and other cattlewomen developed tools to educate kids on how meat products make their way to the supermarket.
We teach them about our industry and have a DVD of ranch life from a child's perspective so that those children can get an idea of what children their same age are doing if living out here on a cattle ranch.
She has a real heart for kids. And so she has no problem bringing our kids and her own into these settings and allowing them an opportunity to promote beef and do community service themselves. She gives those kids a chance to work.
They play a big role in educating the public and trying to educate children on their food and where it comes from and what the cattlemen do every day.
Sheila's work, on and off horseback, earned her the title as Kern County Cattlewoman of the Year.
Anything that Sheila does, she gives 110%. Doesn't matter whether it's here on the ranch or with the Cattle Women's Organization or at church, taking care of the kids, She puts everything into it.
She is not afraid to just put herself out there and work hard and put the Kern County Cattlewomen Association out in the community, whether it's at the fair or getting into the classrooms to talk about ag or any other community event.
Tending their stock on horseback, ranching in this Southern California hill country gives family members the chance to work side by side.
Not many people get to work with their mom, especially out working cattle on horseback and stuff. So, and she's a good hand. She helps my dad out a lot. She's out there every day doing things anybody, any other cowboy could do.
Sheila says her work to promote the cattle industry is an effort to let consumers understand that ranching can be one way to promote green technologies through renewable resources.
The fact that our cattle can go out here and utilize this grass and convert that to a commodity that we can use to feed our country is a proper utilization of the resources out here.
I feel very blessed to be a part of this family and a part of the legacy that they have built.
Cattle ranching in America predates the Republic. Mexican vaqueros were herding cattle in the Southwest as far back as the 16th century. And while we think about branding cattle as an American invention, it's much older than that. In fact, Egyptians were branding cattle in the time of the pyramids.
I'm Sarah Gardner. Still ahead, we're in Hawaii harvesting palms. Now, we're not talking coconuts here. On the Big Island, farmers are harvesting plantation palms to create a very special ingredient used in everything from soups to salads.
I'm Rob Stewart, and still ahead on America's Heartland, we'll take you to New Orleans, where Louisiana sugarcane is being turned into world-famous rum.
Hello, I'm Paul Robbins, and here's something you may not have known about agriculture. You like beets? You may have only tried the canned variety, but a lot of folks like to roast them with a little red wine vinegar. But long before beets showed up on your dinner table, folks were wearing them on their backs.
Beets, which are botanically known as Beta vulgaris, how's that for a name, were originally grown in countries around the Mediterranean, but way back in Roman times, they were raised for the medicinal properties of the beet leaves rather than that bulbous root that we eat today. But credit the French for making beets popular with foodies. Once elevated to haute cuisine, beets could be found on dinner tables in the Old World and the New. But their uses in colonial times went well beyond something to serve with roast meat.
That's because some early settlers captured the red color of mashed beets and used that coloring as a clothing dye long before chemical dyes were invented. And beet dyes are still used today. In fact, dried beet powder is often used as a coloring agent to increase the redness of the tomato sauce on your frozen pizza.
Whether you're trying to lose weight or you just want to eat better, many of us are choosing to eat more produce. That's great news for farmers. Here in Hawaii, that produce pick is palms. Hawaii is well known for the beauty of its blue Pacific waters and dramatic tropical landscapes. But you may not have realized that Hawaii's rich soil and year-round tropical weather also make it ideal for many farmers. And perfect for Leslie Hill and Michael Crowell. They met at the University of Hawaii School of Agriculture. From the beginning, they knew that they wanted to farm.
Realized we were quite compatible and decided, hey, let's try farming together.
So, in 1994, they started the Wailea Ag Group on Hawaii's Big Island. In addition to flowers, citrus, and produce, they began growing something different.
Heart of palm is definitely our main crop, and it is something that we've been actually pioneering in because it was a new crop for Hawaii.
Originally grown in Central and South America, heart of palm is the tender, edible point at the growing tip of the peach palm tree. Michael and Leslie's farm is one of the largest fresh heart of palm producers in America.
We were kind of looking at the bigger picture. You know, because there was all this empty sugarcane land, they needed new crops.
In the early 70s, Hawaiian sugarcane production declined because of cheaper labor overseas.
So they needed something else that they could grow here that would be sustainable and that future generations would be able to continue to harvest from.
But the couple's agricultural plans went well beyond their own 110 acres. They helped to jumpstart other small farms, replacing sugarcane with palm plants.
We have wanted it to become a minor industry in the state of Hawaii. We were known for our sugar, our pineapple. We're known for our Kona coffee, even the chocolate that's being produced. We should be known for our fresh Hawaiian Heart of Palm.
Heart of Palm is a renewable and sustainable resource because it continues to produce new shoots. So harvesting doesn't harm the mother plant. Important to Michael and Leslie's view of sustainable agriculture.
We feel it's important to take care of the land. Stewardship of the land is one of our primary missions.
Harvesting this type of crop is a lot of work.
Harvesting is still done by hand, where they go out with machetes with their proper protection equipment on, of course, where they actually cut the palm down, cut up all the excess fronds. That all goes down in the field, and they bring those, what we call logs, into the packing shed. And from there, they're stripped down farther and then cut to size and packaged.
Shipping between 12 to 15 tons of palm a year, Heart of Palm is harvested year-round and is shipped fresh.
We're actually shipping primarily to the United States right now. At this moment in time, with the economy the way it's been, the bulk of our production is being sold locally in Hawaii at the fine dining restaurants around Hawaii. People ask us that often, what does it taste like? And I usually will just hand them a taste of it. When it's lightly cooked, heated up, it can taste a little bit like maybe a fresh sweet corn. Some people compare it to artichoke hearts. But to me, it has its own unique flavor.
The efforts to encourage new crops have helped Michael and Leslie realize that their love of farming is only a reflection of their love for the land.
You take care of the land will take care of you. So for me, this is really kind of fulfilling a dream. And we feel with the kind of crops that we planted here and the method of planting that we will be able to keep the land and intact for future generations.
When it comes to island agriculture, Hawaii is a world leader in the production of orchids and macadamia nuts. And here's a foodie fact for you. British explorers first named Hawaii the Sandwich Islands to honor the Earl of Sandwich, after whom the sandwich also gets its name.
My name is Rick Snyder. I'm a biometeorology specialist. My job is to work with biology and atmospheric science and how they relate together. Biometeorology is really a combination of physics, chemistry, and biology. It's putting them all together and trying to come up with solutions to problems that farmers and even urban landscape people, they face every day. To measure wind speed and direction. So I work a lot on evapotranspiration of crops and frost protection, anything related to weather and how it affects crop production. Basically, how do you make weather measurements? How do you make measurements on plants? How do you figure out the effect of one on the other? Well, this is the bottom of the lysimeter. I also work on how to take information that's pretty complicated and try to get it down so it's easier to understand what's going on, what you should do. You know, in response to different weather conditions to try to optimize your crop production, reduce the use of energy and water and so on, try to make things efficient. A lot of times I get calls from farmers about frost protection. They want to know, are there different methods that they could use? How much do they cost? How do they work? This is a standard weather shelter box. If you look at most of the problems that farmers are faced with, it's usually pest management problems, water availability problems. All those things are related to the weather. And if we understand the weather better, we're going to be able to deal with those problems better.
You
You know, a lot of American farm products are used for beverages sold all across the world. Here in Louisiana, sugarcane is a huge crop, but it is also the key ingredient to a one-of-a-kind beverage, Old New Orleans rum.
Come on in. Welcome to Bourbon Street.
The Big Easy, New Orleans, where celebrating is a way of life and enjoying fine spirits is part of Louisiana's cultural heritage.
Just a little taste there.
Especially those created from locally grown crops like sugarcane.
New Orleans is a culture of celebration, and a big part of that is the enjoyment, the responsible enjoyment of spirits.
James Michalopoulos is a renowned local artist. 15 years ago, he decided to spread his creative wings to produce more than just artwork. That's when he brewed his first batch of what is now Old New Orleans rum. In fact, each bottle is graced with a copy of his artwork.
I did a science project, I think, when I was in third or fourth grade. I built a little distillery, and it never left me. I felt very impacted by that little scientific study.
Charged with the daily distillation of this distinctive drink is Chris Sewell, who takes great pride in turning a well-known Louisiana farm crop into rum royale.
We have great sugarcane. It gets processed at a little Imperial Sugar Company. They make a certain formula of molasses for us. It's very specific for fermentation quality.
Next, water is added to the molasses, and then comes the yeast.
And they're modifying that sugar molecule into an alcohol molecule. It takes 3 days to ferment. Once this is ready, it's deemed for distillation.
That process, dating back to the 1830s, uses a machine called a column still. This column still was built in the early 20th century.
This is where you blend art and science.
Absolutely.
Art being your palate.
Yeah. Yes, the art being the palate, being able to detect what tastes good. I mean, that's an art in itself.
The finished product is then aged in these American oak barrels. Similar ones proved invaluable when Hurricane Katrina hit in 2005.
The rum in barrels that was exposed to the waters of Katrina actually acted as a barrier. Now, we were forced to analyze every single barrel of rum. The chemists all said that really what saved us was the fact that wood is a very effective protectant and filter.
The distillery for these distinctive Louisiana spirits sits in a manufacturing district hard hit by Katrina's floodwaters. Stains on the walls and beams are a reminder of the high water that cascaded around the warehouse. Old New Orleans Rum produces four recipes of rum, along with a 10-year-old variety that was aging gracefully in these barrels when the hurricane came ashore.
What do these mean to you? Well, they're, you know, a witness to the early days of the distillery. They are a remnant of the trials and tribulations of the storm.
It took 2 years for James and Chris to bring Old New Orleans rum back from disaster's doorstep. They say it was their way of providing support for the Louisiana sugarcane farmers, as well as the cultural heritage of New Orleans itself.
This is what we've got, you know, and it gets us there. And we go, life is good, let's have a good time, let's get some music on, dance, and have some fun, and we do it, and we make the best of it.
And that's going to do it for us this time from New Orleans. Thank you for traveling the country with us on this edition of America's Heartland. And check out all of our episodes online at americasheartland.org or follow us on some of your favorite sites. We will see you next time right here on America's Heartland.
You can see it in the eyes of every woman and man in America. Living close to the land, there's a love for the country and a pride in the brand. In
in America's heartland, living close, close to the land.
It takes a hound dog's nose to sniff out the elusive mountain lion in the wilds of Northern California.
They're very secretive, you know, they're nocturnal. They are a very hard animal to study, but it's partly for that reason that I find them so intriguing.
After tranquilizing the big cat with a dart, wildlife ecologist Chris Wilmers and colleagues take hair and blood samples, then attach this collar. But this is no mere GPS tracker. It's a high-tech electronic diary recording the animal's location, behavior, and physiology in unprecedented detail.
And this up here has the GPS and all the technology, and then battery power is down here. But we can also communicate with the collars, so we can get data off the collars remotely.
With support from the National Science Foundation, Wilmers and a team at the University of California, Santa Cruz have built this collar to track the cat's movements, metabolism, and habitat preferences.
Well, the big thing that it'll let us do is really understand details about their biology, how they make a living on the landscape, how they get enough calories to sustain themselves and reproduce and have young.
Here is our more recent prototype, so you'll notice they're getting smaller.
Computer engineer Gabriel Elkheim designed sensors for the collars using technology he's developed for autonomous and unmanned aerial vehicles.
We're trying to get something small enough, robust enough, and trying to make this thing very power aware so that it turns on different pieces as it needs and turns them off as appropriate. We actually try to determine in real time what the animal is doing, whether he is trotting, running, walking, pouncing, stalking.
Another team member, biologist Terry Williams, works with dolphins, studying how animals in captivity use energy. She says tests on captive mountain lions could shed light on their metabolic needs, and that could head off deadly confrontations.
And maybe we'll get to a point of saying, I can predict when you shouldn't have sheep out or goats out because I know that this cat is hungry at this time, and therefore let's prevent the problem. That's the power of this technology.
Looking out here in the blue is the GPS locations of 11F. This is a young female.
Wilmers works with state transportation planners to identify range boundaries and select areas for safe crossings such as these to give mountain lions and other wildlife near urban areas safe passage. Keeping close tabs on these felines will hopefully lead to fewer catastrophes. For Science Nation, I'm Miles O'Brien.
I'm Vincent McCauley from Africa 54. This is VOA. Follow us on Africa 54. Go to facebook.com/VOA Africa 54.
Welcome to English in a Minute. American English has a lot of animal idioms. Here is a common one.
Don't count your chickens before they hatch.
Is this expression about math? Or farming?
My boss says, I'm getting a raise. Time to get a new laptop computer and plan my trip to Brazil.
Whoa. I'm happy for you, Jonathan, but has the money actually landed in your bank account?
Well, not exactly, but...
Don't count your chickens before they hatch. Don't count your chickens before they hatch means you should not depend on something until it actually happens. Not every egg grows into a chicken. So you cannot count on having those chickens until they come out or hatch from their eggs. And that's English in a Minute.